And today is Friday, May 31st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, U.S. President Donald Trump is giving Mexico 10 days to stop illegal migrants from heading to the U.S. border or face new sanctions.
Our calculation, looking at about 200 cases of economic sanctions, is about a third of the cases they are successful.
A car bomb targeting a U.S. convoy exploded in the Afghan capital today. It's the second attack in 2 days. And the challenges of fasting during the month of Ramadan when there's 20 hours of daylight. These stories and more are ahead on today's International Edition. The United States is giving Mexico 10 days to stop illegal migrants from heading north to the U.S. border, or the country will be slapped with tariffs on all of its products. U.S. President Donald Trump sent a tweet yesterday evening saying on June 10th, the United States will impose a 5% tariff on all goods coming into our country from Mexico until such a time as illegal migrants coming through Mexico and into our country stop. President Trump said the tariffs will continue to rise monthly, going as high as 25% by October 1st. Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also known as AMLO, responded with his own tweet saying, quote, "social problems are not resolved with taxes or coercive measures," end quote. Trump's announcement of the new tariffs came on the same day Mexico began the formal process to ratify the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement on Trade. Now, to dive deeper into the ramifications of President Trump's latest plans to implement tariffs, I spoke with Gary Huffbauer, non-resident senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Gary started our conversation by explaining how the International Emergency Economic Powers Act allows the president to implement tariffs like these.
Back in 1917, Congress passed the Trading with the Enemy Act of 1917. Which in time of war gives the president power to interrupt all trade, all investment, and seize and freeze foreign assets with anyone, not just with the country that the U.S. is at war with, but any other foreign country. That's the Trading with the Enemy Act, a very powerful act. It's still in force. In 1977, the Congress wanted to update and President Carter wanted to modernize this statute, which had been used. And so we have the International Emergency Economic Powers Act of 1977. And the difference, the big difference, is that it's in times of national emergency. It has virtually all the powers that the Trading with the Enemy Act has, except freezing and seizing foreign assets. Other powers interrupting trade are all there. So what he's doing is consistent with the IEEPA law, which has been invoked many, many times. It's the standard legislative tool for all the sanctions.
When announcing these new tariffs, President Trump said, quote, companies that relocate to the United States will not pay the tariffs or be affected in any way. And that's the end of the quote there. But tariffs are not paid by those necessary companies that are in Mexico. Is that correct? Who actually pays for the tariffs?
Well, the tariffs are collected at the border by the Customs Authority, by the Customs, CBP, Customs and Border Protection. And when goods come in, the importer of record pays, actually writes the check. Now, whoever writes the check, that doesn't necessarily mean who bears the full instance of the tariff going forward. That will normally be the consumer.
If we take a look at this proposed scheme, has a tariff scheme like this been used before in this way to bring about a change in immigration policy, per se? And are tariff schemes like this effective in any way?
Well, this is novel. This is completely novel. We've never had a scheme like this. The attempt is to use the tariff as a device for getting AMLO to use his police and military to stop immigrants, presumably at the southern border of Mexico, and to round them up as they reach the northern border of Mexico. That's the purpose. But we've never had a purpose like that before. Now, are they successful? Our calculation, looking at about 200 cases of economic sanctions over the last many years, last century really, is about a third of the cases, they are successful. What often happens with a economic sanction, which is what this is to provoke a nationalist reaction in the sanctioned country.
The new United States-Mexico trade agreement has yet to be ratified. What's your take on how this new tariff scheme may impact that ratification process?
Oh, it's on, as far as I could say, it's on ice. I don't see how the ratification can go forward, either in this country or in Mexico, and maybe not even in Canada while this tariff is in place, because this upsets the basis of the bargain. I mean, you know, the bargain is zero tariffs. So, you know, when that basic feature is upset, why would anyone go forward and ratify this agreement?
And that was Gary Huffbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics here in Washington. Taking a look at the global stock market, stocks fell sharply one day after the announced tariffs on imports from Mexico, magnifying concerns about the economic impact of the U.S. trade disputes around the world. Germany's DAX was down 1.5%, while France's CAC shed just under 1%. Britain's FTSE 100 slid more than 1%, and in the United States, the Dow Jones Industrial Average, the S&P 500, and NASDAQ were all down about 1% lower at midday trading. In Asia, Japan's benchmark Nikkei 225 dropped 1.6%. South Korea's Kospi gained about 0.1%, and Hong Kong's Hang Seng fell 0.8%, and the Shanghai Composite lost 0.2%. A car bomb targeting U.S. convoy exploded in the Afghan capital today. Officials said the attack wounded four U.S. service members and caused a number of other casualties. It's the second attack in the city in just 2 days. This blast survivor classified it as a suicide attack and was unsure how many other people were killed. He said he was hit by flying glass and said others were injured as well. The Taliban has claimed responsibility for the blast, which came a day after the Islamic State militant group claimed a suicide attack outside a military training academy that killed at least six people. There were conflicting reports about the total number of casualties caused by the blast. Well, a spokesman for the U.S. forces in Afghanistan said a car bomb hit a U.S. convoy and four service members had suffered minor injuries, but gave no other details. Friday's attack, shortly before next week's Eid holiday, came as a delegation of Taliban officials met senior Afghan politicians in Moscow for discussions about a possible peace process to end the 18 years of war in Afghanistan. And here are other major stories from around the world. The Financial Times is reporting that tech giant Huawei has ordered its employees to cancel technical meetings with American contracts and has sent home numerous U.S. employees working at its Chinese headquarters. The U.N. atomic watchdog said Friday that Iran continues to stay within limitations set by the 2015 nuclear deal with major powers, but reported its stockpiles of low-enriched uranium and heavy water are growing. Hungary's foreign minister says underwater visibility in the Danube River, where the sunken tour boat is located, is practically zero, complicating efforts to salvage the wreck. Seven people were killed when the boat sunk. 21 people remain missing. You'll find these stories and more at our website, and this is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of Japanese astronomers says they have observed about 1,800 new supernovae in the distant universe. The team says 400 of them are classified as Type 1A supernovae, with 58 of them more than 8 billion light-years from Earth. Astronomers consider these Type 1A supernovae to be valuable because they are used to measure the expansion of the universe. To make their discoveries, the astronomers use the National Astronomical Observatory of Japan's Subaru Telescope atop Mauna Kea in Hawaii. A supernova is the quick but catastrophic explosion that marks the end of a massive star's life. The explosion produces a light so bright that it can outshine an entire galaxy. A supernova may take weeks or months to reach maximum brightness. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Acting Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan says he will call out China's bad behavior in a speech tomorrow, including what he termed the excessive militarization of man-made islands in the South China Sea. Shanahan says China's installation of long runways and surface-to-air missiles on the outposts amounts to overkill and goes beyond defensive measures. He spoke to reporters just before meeting with Chinese Defense Minister Wei Feng-he at the Shangri-La Dialogue National Security Conference. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb is traveling with the acting defense secretary, and I spoke with her earlier. Carla, can you give us a preview of what we expect acting secretary Pat Shanahan to say during his speech on Saturday?
He plans to call out China's bad behavior, frankly. He said that this may be viewed as a spicy kind of part of the speech, but he said that it's important to note that China's installation of their long runways and surface-to-air missiles on these man-made islands is what he called overkill and excessive. And he said it's not defensive at all. And he said that maybe tomorrow he's going to use the term a toolkit for coercion. But as he is calling out this bad behavior, he's also looking to smooth things over, because as there are these global conflicts between the United States and China, whether they are military confrontations or whether they are with the trade war that's going on between the United States and China, he knows that the Asia-Pacific region is looking to these two countries to work together. And I just heard the Singapore Prime Minister say that the U.S. and China have to work together and not upend the global system, but rather bring it up to date. There's a lot of anxiety here about the U.S. and China, and so I think that Shanahan has to serve as sort of a reassurer-in-chief over here in the Asia-Pacific to help people understand that it doesn't all have to be confrontational.
Speaking of that meeting that Shanahan had with his Chinese counterpart, what do we know thus far about that recent get-together?
Well, we know that they had a 20-minute engagement. This was pretty important because the Chinese have not attended the Shangri-La Defense Forum for several years. So this was the first time that the Chinese defense minister was here. And so they discussed ways to better cooperate. They discussed ways that they could avoid misunderstanding and miscalculation. I don't feel that Shanahan wanted to rub China the wrong way by taking the entire time to talk about the South China Sea. But he has reassured allies here that he is standing up for international trade and open waterways in the South China Sea. And as long as there's an international waterway, he feels that China's claims are disputed and the United States will continue to kind of stick up for the region and continue to deploy people to the region. He also said that the United States military was going to start increasing the exercises. He said you're going to see a larger presence of the United States military vis-a-vis exercises and interactions.
What else is in store for the acting secretary this weekend?
Well, he has already had several bilateral and multilateral meetings, but an important meeting that he's going to have is a trilateral with the Japanese defense minister and the Korean defense minister. The Japanese and the Koreans have been a bit on the odds because of different diplomatic situations, and he wants to kind of be the person to smooth over that relationship. Japan and South Korea are arguably the two largest allies of the United States in the Pacific. They are going to be key to curbing anything with North Korea. They are going to be key to bringing the Chinese over to a more global order in the Pacific. And so he believes that will be a very key meeting.
And that was VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb in Singapore. And you're listening to VOA's International Edition.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, an examination of the presidential elections in Malawi and South Africa. Peter Mutharika and Cyril Ramaphosa both won. But do their victories reflect the will of the people? The power of incumbency on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. On June 4, 1989, a bloody crackdown by the Chinese government on a student-led pro-democracy movement in China shocked the world. 30 years later, student leaders and activists of the movement attended a recent conference in Washington, D.C., a suburb just outside the city center, where they talked about what happened in Beijing's Tiananmen Square and why. VOA's Xiao Yu and Hai Lun filed this report, narrated by Anna Cook.
On the night of June 3, 1989, crowds gathered on Tiananmen Square in the center of Beijing. Among them was Yan Jiaqi, then director of the Political Research Institute of the Chinese Academy of Social Sciences.
Later, I realized at that moment shots had already been fired, but the hundreds of thousands of people at Tiananmen Square didn't see what was coming at them.
Armed troops and military vehicles advanced toward the protesters on Tiananmen Square from different directions outside the city. Those in the square had no idea what was approaching them. And around midnight, Yan returned home.
As I fell asleep around 1 or 2 a.m., I suddenly heard loud gunshots that sounded just like firecrackers, but the sound was much louder and sharper. We ran toward the balcony to take a look. Our balcony was on the east side of the alley where you could see East Chang'an Street. We saw a lot of flashes and tense ones. At that time, I knew they had opened fire, and I thought China had really changed.
That evening, along dimly lit streets, journalist Wang Juntao watched soldiers fire relentlessly on the crowd.
People attacked a few vehicles with bricks, marching forward, screaming, one, two, three. They stood together. Those bricks struck like raindrops. And as the bricks were thrown, the soldiers continued to fire.
Wang, who spoke recently at a forum in a Washington suburb along with other Tiananmen survivors, said some memories are still vivid 30 years later.
I saw for the first time a human die with eyes still wide open. His face was looking up at the sky and his head was streaming down with blood. My head felt numb. It occurred to me that day was going to remain as a solemn day in China's history. China's politics was taking a huge step backwards.
On the night of June 3rd, when Peking University student Wang Dan heard that troops had opened fire, his initial reaction was disbelief.
From payphones on Chang'an Street, students called each other to spread the news that the government troops had opened fire at protesters. When the calls first came in, I still didn't believe what was said. But later, as calls increased, I realized it must be true. For 2 or 3 days, I had absolutely no thoughts because, you know, your brain turns numb with big shocks.
Looking back at Tiananmen, Su Xiaokang, who is now living in exile in the U.S., says the fallout from Tiananmen among China's leaders shaped the country's politics in the years that followed. A small faction of hardliners took power, he said, and have kept it, handing it off to their children, who are known as princelings.
The current political and economic systems were formed as princelings came to power. All of China's assets are in the hands of 200 families, which has led to the economic development at the total cost of the environment.
Yan Jiaqi says the government's inability to own up to what happened that night continues to hold the country back.
What happened on June 4, 1989 needs to be corrected to all of China as a massacre, an act of crime on the people executed by the Communist Party. China as a country will never move forward if the truth about June 4, 1989 is not told. Without justice, China will have no future.
Talk of Tiananmen remains heavily censored in China, where the bloody crackdown is still referred to by the government as a counter-revolutionary riot. For Xiaoyu and Hailun, this is Anna Cook, VOA News, Washington.
Muslims in the U.S. state of Alaska face nearly 20 hours of daylight during the fasting month of Ramadan. VOA Hauser reporter Yusuf Arande went to Alaska to see how some Muslims are adjusting to the long days.
This time of the year in Alaska, the sun shines nearly all day. During Ramadan, that is a challenge for Sadiku Muhammad's family.
Fasting in Alaska is amazing. The sun rises at about 4 o'clock a.m. and sets at around midnight. As such, we fast from 4 a.m. till 12 a.m. I have never fasted for more than 12 hours in my life.
Muhammad's mother, Hajja Serena, says Ramadan fasting is easier in Alaska than in the heat of West Africa.
The weather here is cool, so I can fast without even eating anything. I don't feel hungry at all. But in Ghana, due to the heat, you will be eager to break the fast. Since I have been fasting here, I have never worried about how long it is.
Some Muslims in Alaska observe fasting based on the daylight hours in Mecca to compensate for how much daylight can vary here so close to the Arctic Circle. Atu Chaudhry worships at the Islamic Center of Fairbanks.
And in summer, the days could be here could be as long as 21 hours. In December, the days could be only as long as 3 hours. So we've been told by, not me, by our scholars, to follow a standard time zone, and mashallah, what we do, we stick to the time frame of Mecca, which is our holiest place. We do stay fast from 4 in the morning to almost 7 in the afternoon. We breakfast and we do the routine things. We pray 5 times, just like any other Thai people do.
Chaudhry's wife, Zakia, says Ramadan in Alaska is not so different from Ramadan in Bangladesh.
Whatever we do back home, we also do here. We eat suhoor, we eat iftar, we fast the whole day, and we sometimes spend time with the community that we also do back home. The only thing we miss here is that back home, a lot of Muslims around the neighborhood.
So, Muslims here says they do best they can. Hasib Ali moved to Alaska from Sudan.
We cannot match the way we do Ramadan home. One of these traditions is the joyness or the enjoyment of Ramadan during night times and not working during daytime. Here there is no way you cannot go to work in the right time, the right place. However, we ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to accept our intention of fasting according to Alaska's time, which we break the fast and the sun is still there.
In a state 3 times the size of Nigeria, Muslims in Alaska says they are fulfilling their traditions in the ways they honor their community and their faiths. Yusuf Aliyu Harande for VOA News, Fairbanks, Alaska.
There is a winner in the annual Scripps National Spelling Bee, 8 times over. AP Entertainment editor Oscar Wells Gabriel explains the outcome of what was a letter-perfect night.
Usually at the end of the National Spelling Bee, the winner is seen holding the trophy over his or her head. This year, the money shot was of all 8 winners with their hands on the big prize. Bee officials determined that they just might run out of words before the final field of 8 could be whittled down to a champion, so they decided that all 8 would become co-champions if they were to finish 3 more rounds. The co-winners closed out the bee by spelling 47 straight words without a miss. They will not have to split the spoils. Each gets a winner's share of $50,000 and a trophy to call their very own. I'm Oscar Wells Gabriel.
And the 6 boys and 2 girls range in age from 12 to 14 and came from 6 states: Alabama, California, Maryland, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Texas. This was the first 8-way tie in the 94-year history of that competition. And that is going to do it for us today. On behalf of our director, Dan Brown, and our special engineer, Nick Ivanov, thank you for joining us. Don't forget, with our VOA mobile app, you can download our stories and take them with you. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller. Have a fantastic Friday and an amazing weekend.